Connecting the city and surrounding villages. You've found Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, your fortnightly food and drink programme for Cambridge. I'm Matt Bentman.
I'm Ruth Reyes.
And I'm Alan Alder. Our thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the last 2 hours of music. And I'd also like to wish a big Flavour welcome to the returning university students and the new first years.
Yeah, and we hope you'll enjoy tuning in to find out about the latest foodie happenings in Cambridge, as well as plenty of interesting features and events. Flavour's been running for 8 years and there's always plenty of things to cover, from the newest to the well-established. You've been serving the city for decades, even generations. So here's Ruth to begin our rundown.
Coming up on today's programme, there's a new company in town, the Cambridge Food Assembly, who will allow you to buy fresh and direct from the producer.
The popularity of street food continues apace in Cambridge. We catch up with one of its latest entrants, Rusty Strasser, who you'll be hearing in just a few moments.
And Cambridge development continues too. We talk with Polly Pluvier from the City Council. She's heading up a regeneration project around Mitcham's Corner, and we'll find out what it means for foodies in the area.
The smell of freshly baked artisan bread fills the air with our feature on Dovecot Bakery, who make long-fermented wholemeal loaves, spelt sourdough, and a host of other specialty breads.
Grub Club Cambridge are a networking company for food producers and food lovers. They were at Burwash Manor this week, so Pina Broccoli and I have caught up with them for a chat.
Alice Archer from the Cambridge Wine Merchants returns to give us a few aural illustrations around the world of gin.
And we'll round off the programme with a selection of the latest food and drink news from the university and the city. So, let's begin.
New to the ever-growing street food community is Rusty Strasser with a Swiss-inspired menu. Ruth spoke with Ben Whittaker about his venture.
Right, I'm here with Ben of Rusty Strasser. You guys are new to the Cambridge street food scene. How long have you been going?
Well, we've been going since about July. We started off fairly low-key and just did a couple of events to see how it went and feedback was really quite good, and so we've carried on doing it. We had a break for a few weeks, but now we're back doing it, and we're going to be doing it full time pretty much in the next month or so.
Amazing. Where can we catch you?
Well, at the moment we're trading at the food park lunch markets, so you can catch us up at the station. We'll be looking to expand those to some of their other markets in the coming months. We're doing their night market, and we're basically looking for other events to do as soon as we can.
Tell us, for those who don't know, what is a rösti?
Well, a rösti is quite a rustic Swiss dish, traditionally made by farmers, you know, literally just from grated potato with no other ingredients. And often at breakfast, they would have that with, you know, perhaps a fried egg on top. As it's developed and got a bit more gastronomic, spinach and fried eggs are a particularly popular way of serving it. Often you'll find it as a side dish with dishes in Switzerland. We've taken that dish and made a sort of street version of it so that it's suitable for the way that we're operating our street food gazebo kumban. It makes a really, really scrumptious space to put a wide range of toppings on. So we've got, for example, our hun, which translated literally means chicken or hen, and that's a chicken and mushroom one, and it's topped with molten Gruyere cheese, which is, you know, really, really, really tasty. So that's what we do. We get the base rösti, which ours are a bit of a souped up version, so not literally just the grated potato. We've got Appellation Controle Gruyere cheese in there, some cream, seasoning, butter, onion, which makes for a really tasty base, and then we've got a range of the different toppings that we've put on top.
What's your favourite topping?
Oh, my favourite topping is probably the spinach and toasted pine nut one, again with melted Gruyere cheese on top. It's the melted cheese that really makes them, you know, that bit more tasty. Yeah.
Delicious. So why rösti? Why did you choose to do that?
It probably comes originally from holidays in the Swiss Alps. Touring all over Switzerland. I'm not a skier, but we go in the summertime when, you know, it's really lush and green. There's some great produce there. And, you know, we sampled Rostis. I quite often go for city breaks to Bern, which is where the Rosti originated from. And, you know, just really loved it there. I wanted to get into the street food scene here in Cambridge. So I was looking also what's being done and what's not being done already. And so this seemed like quite a novel and different thing to bring to the streets of Cambridge. So the great thing about our Rosties is that they're all gluten-free, and that seems to go down quite well with people. They don't have to worry about that. They're sort of safe in the knowledge that anything they order from our menu is gluten-free.
What other toppings do you have on your menu aside from the hen?
Hun, yeah. So we've got a spinach and pine nut one, which I mentioned earlier, and then we do lax, which is a salmon. So that's smoked salmon with rocket and a creme fraiche lemon and dill dressing on top of that one. That's perhaps a bit of a lighter option if you don't want the melted Gruyere on top. And we're just starting this week to do an air-dried mountain ham topped one, again with mushrooms and Gruyere cheese. But the Rosti itself, it's quite important that you get a decent potato variety. You need quite a yellow, waxy potato that's going to grate quite well and hold its shape once it's been grated. We use an Estima potato or Villa, which originates in the Netherlands, but are grown here. Sometimes you could use a Charlotte potato, but they're quite small. So when you're mass producing Rosties, they're not the best one to be using. But for home cooking, a Charlotte potato would be great.
Where else do you get your ingredients? Are any of them from anywhere special or...?
Not particularly. We try to source all of our ingredients as locally as possible. We use Cambridge Organic Food Company for some of the ingredients. A few local farmers we get them from as well. Just trying to keep things as local as possible. Potatoes can be a bit seasonal, so we do sometimes have to look a bit further afield to make sure that we're getting, you know, good quality potatoes.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. It's great meeting you.
Yeah, and you. Thanks very much.
You can catch Rosti Strasse tonight at the Food Park Night Market and during the week at Food Park. I've tried the Hun, and I can tell you it was as decadent as delicious as it sounds. Lovely balance of flavours, and who can say no to potatoes and melted Gruyere, really?
Mm. Now, if you're interested in buying fresh food direct from the producer, there's a great new idea starting up in Cambridge. It's called the Cambridge Food Assembly, and Alan went to talk with founder Richard Widows about it.
Richard, planning on setting up a food assembly in Cambridge, but what is a food assembly?
A food assembly is basically an online farmers market where customers make purchases online once a week and come and pick up that produce at a set location.
Whereabouts would that be?
Well, in the one that I'm setting up in Cambridge, at the Espresso Library.
Right. And when would they go and pick it up? Are there fixed times, or they can go and pick it up at any old time?
No, it's a fixed time. So we're still talking to producers and our customers about what would be the best time to actually have the collection. At this point, we're looking at a Monday, Tuesday or Wednesday night to be the most likely time, probably from 6 till 8.
Right. Okay, so let me get this right. There'll be a website, I guess. I'd go on, as a customer, I'd go onto the website, I'd see what's available. Maybe there's meat, maybe there's eggs, maybe there's various types of fruit and vegetables, that
yes.
sort of thing. I'd click on them and perhaps say what quantity I want.
Exactly.
And then go along and what would there be? Would there be a box with my name on it? Or?
So that's one of the unique things about this model is the producers come along, and that's something that we're very conscious about, and something that as I'm talking to producers, that's a commitment that I need them to make, is that they actually come along, you know, if not every week, sometimes they'll send someone to deliver stuff, but as often as possible, the producer will be there so that the customer can actually talk to the producer about the products and really get to know where their food's coming from.
And who are these producers? Are they local people who we might very well have heard of?
Absolutely. One of the keys to the food assembly is about local. And so what I'm doing right now is starting discussions with local producers and trying to see who would be interested in providing via this service.
In a way, it cuts out the supermarket.
Absolutely. That's a key. Another unique thing with this, with the food assembly, is producers keep 83% or over 83% of the sale price. And producers set their own price as well. So they're able to get a fair price for their produce, and really it's about supporting local producers who are doing you know, good things and in sustainable ways as well.
How would prices compare with supermarkets?
On average, food assembly produce, for when you compare it with organics from the supermarket, they think it's about 30% cheaper.
All right.
Just last month, the food assembly actually won the BBC Food and Farming Awards for the best initiative in British food.
So it's a model that already exists by the sound of it.
Absolutely. So the food assembly started in France in 2011, and since then has expanded to now be in a number of different countries like Germany and Belgium and Spain, Italy, and obviously the UK. At the moment, there is around 20-odd assemblies either established or setting up in the UK, perhaps more now, and over 800 in the network totally.
And are there any near to Cambridge?
Not currently. There's quite a few in London, would probably be the closest that I'm aware of.
Right, okay. So one of the advantages of somewhere like Espresso Library is that there is on-street parking round the corner at that time of night.
Yes, there is parking accessible. That's one of the difficulties I had in finding a venue in Cambridge, is finding good parking. And I think Espresso Library, there is good parking close enough to be useful.
Any idea when it might begin?
I'm probably going to aim for November now, and I haven't set a fixed date yet.
How can people find out more?
Go to the website. Thefoodassembly.com. They'll see a map and they'll see Cambridge listed on that map. They can go through and register as a customer with the Cambridge Food Assembly, and that way as things progress they'll be kept up to date. And for any producers listening, anyone that might be interested in being a supplier to the assembly can get in touch with me as well.
Great. Via the
website.
Brilliant. Okay, thanks very much, Rich.
Thank you.
And good luck with it.
Cheers.
And a reminder of that website address, it's thefoodassembly.com. Just click on the correct part of the map, you get a form, fill it in, and you're there. And we'll bring you updates from the Cambridge Food Assembly as we get them. And by the way, Espresso Library's extended its opening hours. It's now open from 7 till 11, Monday to Saturday, with a bar, and from 9 till 6 on Sundays.
Mid-mornings from 10 till 1, every weekday.
Join me, Lee Chambers, on Monday with theme tracks around something in the news. And at 10 to the hour, a slice of cheesy music. You love it, don't deny it. And at 11:30, my guests will be among the movers and shakers in this beautiful city.
This is Mandy Morton. I'm here every Tuesday with the classic album Long Play and the Tuesday Review from theatre or cinema.
It's Phil Rowe here on Wednesday, featuring the Mystery Year, Album of the Day, and guests talking about actions and events taking place in your local community.
This is Mike Pryor. I'm here every Thursday with a whole host of great music and features, including six decades of number ones, the Mystery Year quiz, a look at what happened on this day, the Double Dance classics, and our coffee break segues.
And rounding off the week, it's me, Lee Chambers, back again on Friday with theme music around something in the news and a slice of cheese at 10 to the hour. And at 11:30, my guests will be among the movers and shakers in this beautiful city.
Mid-mornings on Cambridge 105. Daytime.
A few years ago, Cambridge was dubbed the worst clone town in Britain. It was all over the papers and the news. Clone town, because we have the least diverse high street in the country. It's full of chains. But the key word there was high street. Now, we have plenty of other streets that are lively, full of variety, with independent shops. And last November, Cambridge City Council appointed a local resident who ran one of these independent shops to revamp a north section of Cambridge. I spoke with her about that ongoing project this week.
Hi, my name is Polly Pluvier. I have been put into place working with the City Council in the area of Mitcham's Corner and Chesterton Road. The remit of my job is to work with the traders as a sort of build-up in the next couple of years to some big changes that will be taking place in the area and the layout at Mitcham's Corner, the famous gyratory system, the roundabout system that has many problems. Now there's going to be some money allocated to it. So my role is working with the local community, the traders, local businesses, to find out what we can bring to the area to highlight it as it's going through this reincarnation.
So we're talking shops, events, life, accessibility, regeneration, yes?
Well, this is where it is really exciting, because the gardens of the huge terrace houses that dominate the area were compulsory purchase to put in the gyratory many years ago, 1978. With this consultation that's going on at the moment, we're looking at trying to bring back an area that's going to be more of a sort of village green area. And one idea is to close off the bottom of Victoria Road and divert the traffic down one of the side streets. That then, behind Staples and right down to in front of the Portland Arms, would be grass or a village green type area. This would bring back the feeling of it being a sort of local high street, which is crying out for, basically, and a heart to the area, which has been missing. On the 5th and 6th of September, we held the first event called the Mitchums and Moore Festival. It was held at the back of Barclays Bank, so it's in the car park, which they've kindly given us, and hopefully they'll give us again for a Christmas event. The first day was a food and wine fair, and that involved local street food vans coming along.
Hi, my name's Kate from Providence Kitchen.
Also Thirsty Cambridge, which is a new business which has taken over Threshers.
Okay, my name is Matthew Boucher. We've just opened Thirsty Cambridge, which is a new, a revolutionary new idea in drinking wine and beer and cider and sparkling, and we've got coffee on its way as well. So, new business venture, very excited to be on Mitchum's Corner.
Lots of people turned up. The first day was food and wine. And the nice thing about it is that it's had a sort of knock-on effect, because Thirsty Cambridge have teamed up with a lot of the food vans, and now they're regularly coming to Thirsty Wednesday to Saturday.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Enjoy. I think Steak and I were going to sell 50 burgers, but they sold 70, and we certainly took probably 2.5 times our normal takings on that night. So it's a great way of doing business in partnership and making it interesting for people and exciting.
It's low impact in a way. It's so expensive to actually rent a place and the overheads and everything and to run somewhere that actually the street food, you know, is a great solution. It's the mobile kitchen.
This is a local shop for local people.
I mean, the original idea of the Mitchum's Corner thing was to try and bring together, yeah, local people that are a stone throw away, and people wouldn't know that they exist, like Le Dante Language School and the Polish restaurant. So it was to encourage them to take stalls in a public place to highlight their business. And I'd love to see sort of Restaurant 22 and Midsummer House, for instance, you know, at the Christmas event. It would be brilliant. And just to sort of highlight what they're doing and let people know where they are, because, you know, some things are hidden away and they don't need to be, really.
So since your assignments are the Mitchum's Corner regeneration projects,
yeah,
you've seen the mixture of the well-established companies there and also some new ones coming in. You mentioned already Thirsty. We also have Stir.
Yep, so the second new business to come to the area is Stir Cambridge, along Cheston Road towards Elizabeth Bridge roundabout. It's a big site. It used to be a Polish delicatessen opposite the spa. The main focus, it's a community cafe, so it's trying to sort of get the people to come out of their houses in the Deferville area. The main body of the cafe is large, lots of sofa areas, big tables for families. And they've got a big outside area which they're attracting cyclists and rowers as well, so up from the river. It's a big venue, so it can house a lot of people. And it's walking distance, you know, from the river, from Mitchum's Corner, just over the bridge from Elizabeth Bridge, and from town.
Four candles.
Here you are.
No, four candles. Candles for forks.
Now, your passion for small businesses is largely grounded in your experience of running Urban Larder, which you began in, I think it was October 2009.
Yes.
So you know the importance of locally sourcing products and services and how important it is for the businesses that would be on Mitchum's Corner.
Definitely. And I think also the main thing that I learned was collaborations and how important they are, and how to go back to sort of traditional high street venues. You know, how they'll survive is really working with the local community and working with each other.
And that's where the street food pop-up vans are really taking advantage there. You mentioned regeneration. This is a regeneration of sorts that they're doing themselves.
Yeah.
You mentioned Thirsty as well. Now, they were in our previous episode. When I spoke to them, they only had two street food vans that were turning up through the week. Now you're saying they've got four, possibly even five. Yeah. So they've really latched onto this very fast.
Yeah, yeah. And it's been, you know, really successful. It works perfectly because they're outside dealing with the cooking. You come inside, have your drink, sit down and socialise, and you've got a sort of constant turnover. So I'm trying to team up certain people. I know that there's an independent bakery looking for a site at the moment. They would like somewhere that they can bake during the evening and possibly in the traditional way sort of share it with another business so that when the ovens, when they're not baking, the place gets used. So I'm trying to team up people that I know from my sort of previous life that I could possibly house in Mitcham's Corner. So when there are a couple of empty shops and there are, I know one particular, the old jewellery shop, Gawtry's, that the whole building is going up to auction. So it's an interesting site next to 30 Cambridge and it could potentially be a great venue for a new foodie outlet.
Chesterton Road, the Mitcham's Corner area. It's all wrapped around the river, the common and the green.
Yes, and there's the Lock People's Cottage, Jesus Green Lock, which has been purchased by a couple who are going to turn that into a cafe.
Oh.
Yeah, which is going to be fantastic because it will just, you know, lead people across and into Mitcham's Corner even more. And as you say, there's lots of activity actually on the river, a stone's throw away. There's the, you know, the houseboats that are just across on Jesus Green. There's the kids' playground. So it's trying to link the two together and it's trying to really sort of open up through signage, through activities, events, and just get people to walk across that bridge and come over into Mitcham's Corner. The roundabout is at Mitcham's Corner, which is the bane of the area, which is what they're trying to change, is the gyratory system, which all the traffic goes around the roundabout. But what's quite interesting is under there, there are two Victorian, possibly Edwardian, toilets that were filled in the 1970s when the gyratory was put in. Now, this could be quite an interesting business opportunity for someone if the local plan and city deal decide to keep these toilets. They could then be changed into, you know, either an underground music venue, it could be a jazz bar.
Like a cavern?
Or a cafe, which happens a lot, espresso bars and things in London. So, you know, if there's anybody out there got some cash and wants to invest in a really interesting project, please get in touch. Because, again, you know, it's a destination site. You know, you could have a really interesting venue there.
Yeah, and that's what this regeneration is all about. And as you said, there's precedent for this because London does have its underground cafe scene, literally underground, made up of old Victorian bathrooms.
Yeah.
And Mitcham's Corner is going to be perfect for this.
Yeah.
Again, as you say, because you have so many venues around the Portland, the Boathouse,
right.
You have Restaurant 22, there'll be other restaurants opening up, you have Thirsty.
Yeah.
This is an area that can really be up and coming.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's really looking to become a food destination area. Love me do.
When people see what you're going to achieve, the supermarkets, they'll be in there like a shot with their express stores, crowding out the opportunities of independence.
I think there is that potential to become another cloned high street. Hopefully, I can and other people can influence local stakeholders. I mean, I've got a meeting with the owner of the Staples site. I was really pleased to hear that he didn't want a chain in his restaurant unit. He is looking for an independent. So that's reassuring. It's a sort of catch-22 that the more... I mean, it's great having Thirsty and Stir opening up because people are starting to see that, you know, this is an area that's due a lot of development. It's been sort of overlooked for so many years and now it is getting that.
So, Polly, if people want to find out more about the regeneration and other things that are going on around there, how can they find out? Can they contact you?
Yes, they can. And there's currently three Facebook pages. The first one is, if you look at Mitcham's Corner and Chesterton Road, simply,
mm-hmm.
The second one is Well Lit Corner, which there was a couple of projects. We were looking at alternative projects to lighting up the area with a festive light project. But we're still looking for sponsorship for people to light up the trees, but events around raising funds for the festive lights. And the third one is Mitcham's and More Festival. If you look under Mitcham's Triangle, because the Mitcham's and More Festival evolved from the original beer festival that used to take place in Mitcham's Corner. So it's with the original site there called Mitcham's Triangle. And on Twitter, we're at Mitcham's Corner.
Lovely. Well, Polly Pluvier, the Mitcham's Corner and Chesterton Road coordinator, thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
We're looking forward to seeing some of those changes come into effect. There's the possibility of using the car park behind Barclays, which is off the main road, safe and surrounded by trees, as a possible regular monthly pop-up market.
Yeah, and I'd love to see some of those underground cafes and bars sitting alongside the grassy area. It'd be so cool. And there's plenty of opportunity for further development too. Flavour hopes to keep you informed of what could be another potential hub, foodie hub even, for Cambridge. And we recently featured Redmore Farm Shop and Thirsty, the wine and coffee shop from our previous episode. And there's the other recent arrival, Stir, the community cafe, and that may appear in one of our next episodes.
If you've missed one of your favourite shows or interviews, listen to a selection of them again on our website. From local food and drink reviews with Flavour, what's hot or not at Cambridge's cinemas with bums on seats, or the best of the guests from 105 Daytime. There's something for everyone. Visit cambridge105.fm and get downloading now.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. We're here live in the studio, and there are many ways to contact us. Via email, studio@cambridge105.fm. You can text on 07919 070490. We're also available on Twitter at Flavour105, or you can email flavour@cambridge105.fm.
Rosie Sykes is back, and she's been speaking with Chris Murray of the excellent Dovecot Bakery about his breads.
How big is your range? You have how many different breads do you make?
If you look at my labels, I mean, I must have, say, 250 of different types of bread.
Good
because
Lord.
I'm forever researching and experimenting. But my main range is quite small and is based around the sourdough wheat, the sourdough rye, three or four wholemeal flours, three or four speciality flours, as well as some yeasted bread that I make for specific customers, like steak and honour.
And so you, for Joe at afternoon teas, you make crumpets as well and muffins?
Yeah.
And is that, do you make them with sourdough or is that yeast?
No, they're yeasted. Mm. They're again, a specific thing. Mm. I did a lot of research pre-Second World War. I mean, then there was a specific job and there was somebody called the Crumpet Man who made nothing but crumpets.
Amazing.
And it was a lost art. The making crumpets is a real art that has been lost.
Mm.
And I kind of did a lot of research, a lot of testing to get that right. And judging by how many sell.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I'd love to be.
Yeah.
I'd love to make. I've never made crumpets, but I would.
But
love
they're made
to.
On a griddle rather than in an oven. So that's the difference.
And do you make an English muffin as well?
Yeah. Again, it's a griddle.
And so when you say you've got probably 200 different labels, you sort of would do one for a while and then maybe stop and do something else?
As things develop or things that I read about or see or people suggest things, I made a sourdough, an apple sourdough for Berochelada because they have an apple celebration.
Oh, yes,
apple
coming
ones.
Up soon,
yeah, yeah,
isn't it?
In the autumn, so I made an apple sourdough using... So, apples.
Okay, so you made a culture from apples.
Yeah.
Ah, amazing.
Yeah.
So the first culture you made, what was it made with?
It was wheat, a wheat culture. But then I did very quickly develop specific rye cultures and even more specific to do with Khorasan flour and, you know, other kind of cultures. I had about seven at one stage.
Gosh. So now you have... Just one culture, or...?
No, I have three now.
Okay.
Yeah, three. My main cultures have all just had flour and water.
So very pure?
Yeah, yeah.
And a specific type of water?
Initially, I started with filtered water, But when I came to Cambridge, I even collected condensation from Midsummer Common.
That's,
wow. Yeah, that's how my main bread is called Midsummer Common, because of my water collection.
So how did you collect the water?
It was in a very Heath Robinson, but it was basically, I'd seen on the TV a documentary of how you would collect water if you were stranded in the desert, involving plastic and a stone, and I did exactly the same. Collected a couple of litres.
That's incredible.
Yeah. But I wanted something that was really authentic, and its provenance was exactly where I lived. And I lived on New Square, and the common was right next door. And so I've called my main range of bread Midsummer after the common.
And do you have a favourite thing to bake, or was there something that you really wanted to develop? Or
one of the things I've been working on was, I came across some information that said a pain de pice was originally a sourdough rye bread that beekeepers would make to use their leftover honey. So it was a rye bread, wow, with honey in it, and then they would spice it. And every beekeeper had their own pain de pice. And so I've researched that, and I've gone right back. So now it's just made as a cake, but I've made it as a rye bread. That's a sourdough that has, and I've teamed up with a local beekeeper. I was a beekeeper as well, so that's, you know, that's where that comes from. To make this amazing rye bread, which is a seasonal thing or festive thing. I'm going to sell it at Christmas time.
Lovely.
Yeah.
In fact, yeah, I have tried a proper, like, but probably not a sourdough, but a yeasted pain de pice, and it had little bits of candied peel in it as well.
Yeah.
And really lovely, really nice toasted. Oh, that's really exciting, Chris. It is, So where did it all begin?
I started to bake for my daughters. We've got two daughters, Emily and Katie. And when they were little, they needed rolls for their lunch. I brought them up as vegetarians. They couldn't get a good packed lunch, so I started to make them rolls for their lunch. At the same time, I used to take them to the library every Monday, and while they were choosing their storybooks, I started to look at textbooks to do with bread, and I came across Linda Collister's World Breads. In that was profiles of artisan bakers, specifically sourdough bakers. So I started to bake with a sourdough culture myself.
Thanks to Chris Murray and Rosie Sykes for that. You can buy Dovecot Bakery breads from this Shelford deli, Burwash Larder, Daily Bread in Kilmaine Close, the excellent Derby Stores in Derby Street, and Arjuna Whole Foods in Mill Road. And Alan can recommend the crumpets, which sell out incredibly quickly.
Yes, I can.
Now, British Food Fortnight comes to an end tomorrow. Established after the foot and mouth crisis, this is a celebration of national food and drink and its producers, and it's all set to coincide with harvest time. Loads of organisations take part, and there's many events that run up and down the country. Now, Grub Club Cambridge celebrates British Food Fortnight at the Larder in Burwash Manor, and they were also celebrating their first anniversary of being in business.
They're a networking club for those who work in the food and drink industry. Flavour reporter Pina Broccoli Anaya spoke with Grub Club's owners.
I'm here at the Larder at Burwash Manor with Kelly Molson and Vari Russell, the founders of Grub Club Cambridge. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do and how you came together to create Grub Club Cambridge? Let's start with Kelly.
Absolutely.
It's a bit of a mouthful.
It is a little bit of a mouthful. So, well, I moved to Cambridge about 3 years ago. Didn't really know anybody that lived here other than my fiancé and his friends. So I set out to kind of grow my business and social network in the area. I started working from the Cambridge Business Lounge near the Grafton Centre. I run a digital agency which specialises in the food and drink sector. So we build lots of websites.
It's got a great foodie name.
It has got a great foodie name. Yeah, that wasn't set out to be like that. It was just a name that we picked out of thin air.
But, rubber cheese.
Rubber cheese rolls very well off the tongue. But yeah, just over the years, we've developed a niche in the food and drink sector. Anyway, Ed, who runs the Cambridge Business Lounge, introduced me to Vari, who is a food marketing expert. And the two of us kind of started talking, collaborating on a few projects. and had a little bit of an idea about setting up a networking group.
So, Vary, your company is actually called the Food Marketing Expert.
Yep, it is.
So can you tell us a bit more about it and how the collaboration came about to start Grub Club Cambridge?
We are a sales and marketing agency, so we deliver social media, marketing, sales, help people get their products to market. And like Kelly said, we met through Ed, who said, you two need to meet because you'll get on like a house on fire, which I think is an understatement.
That's definitely happened.
And last August, so August 2014, we came up with the brainchild of having a bespoke networking event for the foodie industry, having not found anything that fitted that bill in Cambridgeshire. And we delivered our first event at Gogmagog last September as part of British Food Fortnight. And here we are today, a year later, celebrating our first birthday.
That's right. It's your first birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
British Food Fortnight again here at Burwash Manor, where they specialise in pork and all yummy things.
I know, and the dinner tonight was absolutely amazing.
Can you tell us what dinner was tonight?
We had Burwash's award-winning, they won a Great Taste Award this year for their bangers, a mash with lashings of foraging fox beetroot ketchup. So
that was really good. I never had anything like that before.
It's surprising.
It is available to purchase at Burwash Larder.
Excellent.
Yeah, and then we had Eaton Mess, which was equally delicious. So we're all very full of food and very happy.
And I know that was prepared by Paula Davies Romano of Romano's Kitchen. That she does a lot of stuff for the larder, and she prepared the menu.
Absolutely.
She cooked the menu, and then the menu was designed by the larder.
Absolutely.
And it was really good.
She's an incredible cook. Her sausage rolls and scotch eggs are absolutely to die for.
They are.
Yeah. And we're looking forward to her. She's taking over the coffee shop.
That's right,
which is an exciting foodie
development. Stay tuned for that.
So
how does Grub Club Cambridge work? Is it anybody who can join? Is there a fee? How does it work?
There's no fee. You can pitch up to whichever events you want to come to, but you need to buy a ticket before you come. And we have great conversations on the hashtag Grub Club Cams and a Facebook group, so people can start the conversation before the evening and then carry on the conversations well after. But it's just a platform for people who have a foodie interest and a foodie business to get talking.
I mean, it's specifically aimed at professionals who work in the food and drink industries, and that can be anyone from buyers, producers, farm shop owners, people who market to those industries, so people like us. And it's been phenomenal, actually. I think that we've had really great testimonials and feedback from people that have come along to events, and really interesting things are starting to happen in their business for the connections that they've made here. So conversations start here, but they continue on afterwards, don't they? So we've had people that are now, for instance, Cedric's Charcuterie attended one of our events at Fitzbillies for the Eat Cambridge Festival last year, and they are now a supplier to Fitzbillies. So all those kind of amazing things happen.
They met the girls from Burwash last December at one of our Grub Club events and got listed here at the larder. So it's just making things happen.
Yeah, it's really a great sort of a hub for people to get together and just make those contacts and find out about different restaurants or products and meet the people themselves.
Absolutely.
They're all independently owned or producers. So
I think it's creating opportunity as well. So it's bringing people together that might not necessarily get to meet in a social environment. So there's no hard sell, there's no sales pitch. It's literally just turn up, meet some really interesting people, have some great food and drink.
Yeah, food's always great. I was at the Fitzbillies
Grub
Club back. It was part of Eat Cambridge, and that was fantastic.
Yeah.
Tim Hayward was the speaker there, obviously, and you had an interesting speaker here tonight named Alistair Grant. Yeah.
Yes, Alistair from Bokeh Photographic. So he was our first sponsor, actually. So we've slightly changed the model this year. And it was really interesting because he was able to give us a 15-minute talk on his speciality, and we hope that there'll be future sponsors and future people that can come along and do those kind of things, which makes the evening a little bit more worthwhile for people to come
definitely.
As well.
He specialises in food and drink photography, so that was a really good fit.
And does a wonderful job. And we also sit and discuss who we need to introduce who to.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily like a blind date. That we will make the effort to introduce people to each other that will benefit them.
So how many people would you say were here tonight? There was quite a big group.
So this event itself actually sold out 3 times. The Burwash were absolutely fantastic in every time we sold out, offering us, we can just squeeze 10 more people in and then 10 more. So we actually sold 60 tickets for this evening.
Fantastic.
There was a few people, unfortunately, that couldn't make it along the last minute. Yeah. But there was about, I'd say about 55 people here.
Yeah,
really. It was a fantastic turnout.
Yeah,
it was really great. It was really great.
Thank you.
You can find out more about upcoming Grub Club Cambridge events on their website at grubclubcambridge.co.uk. You can also follow them on Twitter at Grub Club Cams, or look them up on Facebook at Grub Club Cambridge. Thank you for your time, Kelly and Vary.
Thank you so much, Pina. Thank you so much for coming along this evening.
It was my pleasure, and we wish you many more years of success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
And many thanks to Katinka and the team at the larder at Burwash Manor for staying late and keeping the marquee open at the end of the evening whilst the interview was being conducted.
Grub Club Cambridge are one of five finalists for Best Networking Group in this year's East of England Business Champion Awards for Small Businesses. And if you'd like to read more about them and the event that they hosted, just point your web browser towards the site 12culinarystew.com and search for Grub Club Cambridge, or you can find them directly at grubclubcambridge.co.uk.
Every afternoon, 105 Drive wraps up your day with a mix of music and conversation. We'll talk to the people who make Cambridge.
Cambridge got ahead of the game in turning ideas into commercial success.
Keep you up to date on the latest sport.
He was only at Cambridge United for 2 months, but he had a huge impact. He scored the opening goal in the FA Trophy final.
And bring you regular features on food, drink, technology, the movies, and what's happening in town.
I am so excited. This is going to be awesome.
In between, there's the latest news, weather, and travel every 20 minutes to see you through the traffic. Join me, Julian Clover, Monday to Friday from 4, 105 Drive, on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
Alice Archer is back with us. She's a wine advisor at the Cambridge Wine Merchants, and they have four branches around the city. In previous instalments, she's talked about sherry, champagne, South African wines and others, and for this episode, she's gone 37.5% proof. Gintastic.
This is where it gets fun. What we've done now is we've pulled two chairs up against all of your open gin bottles.
Yeah.
And I presume we're going to try each and every one. There's only about 200 bottles here, so we'll be fine.
No one's driving after this. It's fine.
Now, this looks interesting.
So we'll start traditional. This is a gin called £50. This commemorates the £50 gin tax that happened during the gin craze, that anyone wanting to set up a new distillery had to pay £50, right, which was quite a lot in the 18th century. Only two distilleries paid it. Very traditional, lots of juniper on the nose, slightly sort of vanilla-y thing going on there.
I love the smell of
really,
that.
Really, really nice. That is classic gin, really.
A question I typically ask my probation officer is why we can't all make our own gin. Well, we could once. Back in the 1720s, a quarter of houses in London were producing or selling gin because it was safer to drink than the water at the time. Of course, though, public drunkenness became a major problem, and the government introduced licensing laws to end this gin madness. As a result, in the 1820s, gin palaces emerged. Whether you were a rich provincial type or of the lowest caste order, chances are you may have ventured into a gin palace. And gin palaces were grandiose and decorated to a high fashion with polished mahogany, magnificent crystal panes of glass, and the latest in gaslighting. To quote the artist and satirist George Cruikshank, "All is light and brilliancy. The gin shops in and near Drury Lane, Holborn, St Giles's, Covent Garden and Clare Market are the handsomest in London. And there is more of filth and squalid misery near those great thoroughfares than in any part of this mighty city." Fast forward almost 200 years, and gin carries a wholly different perception. On the continent, gin is considered a very fashionable drink amongst the young.
It's a Chablis, of course. I'm getting vanilla and just a threat of oyster shell.
Yeah.
And pebbles in the rain.
What are you getting?
Smoky bacon.
Overbearing aromas of pretentious rubbish. What?
The gin category is now worth nearly £380 million, and recent figures predict a global growth in gin of 11.1% between 2014 and 2019. We're witnessing not only a gin renaissance in the UK and other traditional gin-drinking countries such as Spain, but also a huge gin debut around the rest of the world, be it big brands or small artisan producers. By 1690, London has consumed 1.5 million gallons of gin in a year. With beer taxes being raised at the same time, this made gin the cheapest beverage in England. The 1720s, gin madness spread through London as an escape from the brutal life of the working class. Dram shops advertised drunk for a penny, dead drunk for two pence, and clean straw for nothing. Gin is essentially a flavoured vodka. Any agricultural crop that has a source of sugar can be used to produce a spirit. This spirit is then rectified to about the minimum of 96% to then have botanicals added and become what we know as gin.
The origin of the base may vary for gin, but grain spirits are preferred as they give a slightly crisper texture. We do have those made from others. We've got one made from apples. Bathtub, that's quite a fun one. This is a Chase Williams Elegant Crisp Apple Gin.
Very subtle.
Subtle?
Yeah.
But do you get the apple-y note? I find it slightly bonfire-y, sort of. A bit toffee-appled. I think there's one made from cream now. I think I have come across that. But yes, grain is the most common. By law, juniper must be the dominant flavour of any gin drink.
By law?
By law. I do have the full set of laws of how gin is restricted, but yes, the alcohol must be 96% alcohol first. It then must have a lead juniper content and must not be less than 37.5% final product.
I'm not going to go anywhere with that. Just smells like a lovely classical gin.
It just smells like gin.
Yeah.
Next, this is, I mentioned, a very junipery gin.
Mm-hmm.
So you can really get that peppery, spicy...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Travels down my nostrils there in a much deeper way. It's like it's burrowing in there.
It's also 57.7%. So I wouldn't recommend ordering a double of that one.
Is that all?
That's all. You know, minimum 37. Why not add 20% alcohol? Why not? The alcoholic strength of gin is another important factor for how the flavour profile comes across. The minimum bottling strength in the EU is 37.5%, but most distillers reckon about 40 to 45 is the best balance for the alcohol to hold all the flavours of the botanicals, but also let them shine through. So, this choice of botanicals. The exact recipes are almost always closely guarded secrets. Distillers do not let you know what goes in them. There are a few, most of them name the number. So, for example, we have one called Death's Door, which is an American gin. This has three botanicals. We've got one called Botanist from Ireland, Scotland. It's got 31. We've got one called Monkey 47 from Germany. It's got 47 botanicals. And so it goes on. These come from the world over. Got one from Africa it's from made in Germany, but it's got African baobab and other African botanicals in it. It's not the quantity of the botanicals necessarily, but often the quality. And as with any recipe, it's all about balancing and creating a nice level. We've got a great gin called Pinkster, for example, and their original product is incredibly high on the juniper, mostly because they've got a very light, fresh raspberry as well that goes into it. Fresh raspberries that really is adding a bit of sweetness, and it's cutting down the juniper all the time. If they chose other botanicals, then that juniper element would just be far too high, completely out of it.
Do not tempt him, shallow ones! Is not the miracle of the juniper bushes enough?
I mentioned Oriental gins.
Yes.
Sort of cardamom, botanicals like that. This one, when you're drinking this, it is a bit like drinking a curry.
Oh, wow. Yes, yeah, that's so different.
Mm. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. It's a sort of, it's not a session gin. It's certainly a one-off. You can't drink lots of that because it's so powerful and flavourful. Got a rhubarb gin.
Oh, yes.
Gin blended with rhubarb. Got an orange gin as well. Yes, that one, yeah. Feel free to have a little nose on that if you like.
Yep.
Let's have a look. This is quite a fun one. This is from Cornwall. It's got orange blossom in it.
And fish and pasties.
He does actually make a...
Again, I'm not really picking up anything off of that. I do have a raging cold, though.
This might not be the best one to go for, then. Some botanicals not only add aroma and flavour, but also can mellow out the other flavours and also add texture. Cardamom's an important one, as is nutmeg. You can use fresh orange, or you can use peel, fresh citrus or peel. Some people use frankincense, some people use hops. There are a few interesting ones focusing on local botanicals. We've got one from Leicestershire called Burley, and they use forage botanicals. Again, but the botanist from Isla, they have a team of foragers on Isla. And so their gin changes all the time according to what can be sourced. Got one from Kent that's got samphire in it and hops. One of my all-time favourites has to be blue gin. Because it is a good novelty.
Yeah.
But it's just incredibly classic, really. Good, easy drinking gin. The average price of gin now is about
£19 a litre. So that's including your Gordon's or your Sainsbury's Basics gin and your premium £100 gins. So it's still quite a high price point, especially compared to vodka.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
In conclusion, Winston Churchill is reputed to have said, "The gin and tonic has saved more Englishmen's lives and minds than all the doctors in the empire." What do you think?
That's definitely your second Winston Churchill quote, I think.
Is it?
Yes.
I have a biography of Winston Churchill at home.
Many thanks to Alice Archer of the Cambridge Wine Merchants, and she'll be back in two episodes' time.
Today's Jazz on Jazz Today. Join me, Pete Butchers, for 2 hours of the best in contemporary improvised sounds. Alternate Sundays at 4, here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
On to the food and drink news now, and starting with the universities. With Freshers Week and the start of a new academic year upon us, never has Eat, Drink and Be Merry be a more apt motto for the week. Never mind the term ahead. The University Food and Drink Societies have a whole host of delicious events for you to enjoy this year.
To see all that Cambridge and the societies have to offer, be sure to attend the Societies Fair at Parker's Peace and Kelsey Carriage on Tuesday the 6th and Wednesday the 7th of October next week, from 11 to 6 each day. You can see and sample everything from Cambridge University Chocolate Society to the Cheese Society, Tea, the Real Ale Society, and so many more.
Societies will be releasing their event term cards then, so it's really a must-do if you want to be in the know. But just as a heads up, it looks like first on the scene will be Cambridge University Whiskey Appreciation Society with their Freshers event. Details are to be announced on their website, but the idea is you pay £5 for a raffle ticket which can be exchanged for 5 whiskies. No booking required, just turn up.
And just a few pieces of housekeeping to sort out before the craziness of terms sets in. Cambridge University Chocolate Society are advertising their events purely through their Facebook page now, so like that page to stay involved. And membership for the Cambridge University Whiskey Appreciation Society is due for renewal this month. You can renew or request membership online.
It's going to be a fantastic year for university food and drink, and so exciting to get started. Tasty times ahead.
Yeah, and thanks to Gigi Perry for providing that. Gigi couldn't be with us today, but she will be back in 2 weeks. Meanwhile, in City Food News on the 7th of October, there's a cooking workshop at Barnwell Baptist Church. It's free and runs from 4 to 6 p.m, followed by tea and coffee till 6:30, then until 7:30, a community meal. Take your friends and family, but you do need to book in advance with Sam at cambridgesustainablefood.org.
Now, next Thursday, that's the 8th of October, Tim Hayward is at Waterstones in Sydney Street talking about his new book, DIY Cook. It starts at 7 p.m. and tickets are available from the ground floor till. But if you can't make it, you can listen to our interview with Tim, which is on our podcast from the 8th of August, and it's on the Cambridge 105 website.
On the 9th of October at Sticky Beaks in Hobson Street, Cam Events' October pop-up welcomes back Guillermo of Tapas Atajar. He'll be preparing another traditional artisan Spanish tapas meal to include an array of delicious tapas dishes. It begins at 7:45 and tickets are available at Eventbrite. If you go to the Eventbrite website, you can see the menu. The name is Spanish Tapas and Wines pop-up.
And the Curry Club is back. That's at the Kingston Arms in Kingston Street, and it's on Thursday nights.
Yep, and every Thursday night at the Hotbine Pub in Fair Street, all real ales are £3 a pint.
And we've heard that Saffron Walden's Bicicletta Cafe is going to open a branch in Grantchester soon.
And on the 23rd of October, there's an Ethiopian feast, which is part of the Cambridge African Film Festival. It's a dine and view evening, so you can watch the film Price of Love as you dine on the multi-course meal. Tickets are from Eventbrite. It's called Dine and View.
The 25th of October is Apple Day at the Botanic Gardens in Trumpington Street. Standard admission is £8 and children can get in free. The tasting tables are at the core of Apple Day, offering the region's biggest choice of unusual and heritage apples to try before buying. Harvest highlights this autumn include a great choice of dry and nutty flavoured russets, as well as Ashmead's Kernel, Blenheim Orange and Darcy Spice. And there are rumours, as yet unconfirmed due to the unpredictability of the September sun, of Pitmaston Pineapple and the much sought after Orleans Rennet. Cambridge Food Park stalwarts Gorilla Kitchen and Steak and Honour will be rolling up to join in the fun. Plus, there will be live music from local bands, all adding to these apple celebrations. This is at the Botanic Garden in Trumpington Street, 25th of October.
And there's a whole series of pumpkin-related events happening in October. The Transition Cambridge website is a good place to find out more. Included is Pip's Pumpkin Pop-Up at St Paul's in Hills Road on the 25th of October and the 6th of November, where there'll be a three-course pumpkin-based meal. You eat it and then pay what you think it was worth.
And the menu is a secret. They'll collect all the surplus food donated by local businesses in a couple of days leading up to the event, and then think up three delicious courses with appetizers. Each of the courses will involve pumpkin. For this event, book online with Eventbrite. It's called Pip's Pumpkin Pop-Up.
And that about draws the curtains on today's edition of Flavour. This programme will be repeated tomorrow morning at 7, and after that you can catch our podcast, which should be available in the next few days. You can find it on the Cambridge 105 website, on iTunes, and the Radio Player app, where you can also subscribe to us and find podcasts of our previous editions too.
Remember that you can keep in touch with Cambridge food and drink news by following Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105.
Coming up next is Mandy's Garden Shed, where Mandy Morton will explore the history of the Oakington Garden Centre, discuss the trials and tribulations of her National Trust allotment, and prepare for the coming winter months.
From 2 till 5, it's 105 Sports with Ibrahim Rahman, Jack Swindlehurst and Jack Langley, with the weekend sporting action featuring live updates on matches involving Cambridge United, Cambridge City and Histon.
Cambridge Minds is at 5 with another chance to hear award-winning broadcaster Trevor Dance's first edition of the series, which this week features statistician Sir David John Spiegelhalter and Master of Selwyn College Roger Mosey.
Jason Allen is at 6 with songs from the 80s and 90s, and at 7 p.m. it's Under the Music Tree, hosted by Aidan Coomber, featuring the best underground music, including a new DJ set, reviews, live sessions and more.
Thanks to all of our interviewees today. Our next episode is in 2 weeks' time on Saturday, the 17th of October. We hope you can join us then. So for now, it's goodbye from Flavour.
Bye.
Goodbye.